Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is August 5th, 2004. Today's session number is MOJ 2004-03. Today's speaker is John Moeller. And the lesson for today is Politics as the Way We the People Summon Out What We Shall Be. Let's listen in.
For those of you who haven't been here, my name is John Moeller, and I teach political science at Luther College. And what I've been doing this week is trying to look at the idea of politics as the way that we decide collectively what we will become, what our values are, how we want to do things, and so forth. And what I did on the first day was I talked a little bit about an idea of politics and suggested that politics involves the need to accommodate, it involves a set of principles, it involves the idea of recognizing the empirical reality of the world, it involves an ongoing conversation, and then politics, the process itself, evolves over time. And then what I tried to do a little bit of on Tuesday was to look at the relationship between the principled nature of politics and the more practical needs of politics and the kinds of tensions that exist there. And what I want to think about today a little bit, and I'm going to divide this sort of into two parts. I want to do a little bit of background and then throw out to you to raise some discussions. I want to talk about the role of the courts in terms of summoning out who we're going to be as a people. Because one of the things that's happened, and this is not a new thing in the United States, but it's happened a lot in the United States, I think, in recent years, is the court plays a particular role in establishing public policies, oftentimes at odds with the political conversation or the political process. And I think it's an important thing to think about and to look at. And so I'm going to use the board a little bit today. And one of the what I have in mind here, I guess, is let's say that what I've been talking about is politics is going to ultimately lead to some public policies, and these public policies then will be the way we've defined ourselves. And I've suggested that getting up to those policies might involve different actors conversing, so the legislature, and we might even say, the U.S. Congress, and then down here we've got 50 states, each have their own legislatures down there. We have executives engaging in the conversation. We have courts involved. Tomorrow I'm going to talk about the idea of civil disobedience as being one way of conversing and engaging in the political conversation. And the problem that some people would suggest is happening in America today is on too many occasions the policy is not a result of this interaction and a result of these different actors conversing with each other, but sometimes it seems to get caught in the courts, and then a Supreme Court or a judge somewhere actually makes the decision that becomes the policy for everybody else, which at least first glance would suggest that maybe we've shifted a little way away from this conversation in which everyone's involved. Now, I think there's two ways that this has been happening in the United States today that are kind of interesting. I'll lay out the first one sort of briefly, and then the second one is where really I'd like to spend most of our time thinking about. First, I find it pretty interesting the way that civil litigation has actually become a way of creating public policies. And when I say civil litigation, what I mean is two parties have a dispute with each other. I use the example in my classes, whenever I talk about civil litigation, those of you who know Decorah and know the whippy dip, because I walk to work every day, including the winter, and every time I walk by the whippy dip in the winter, they never shovel their walk. And so everywhere else people are pretty good, but the whippy dip doesn't shovel it. And so I find myself thinking now, if I slipped on the sidewalk in front of the whippy dip, I could sue them, because they were the cause of the injury that I had suffered.
What's a whippy dip?
Whippy dip, I'm sorry. It's a minor league Dairy Queen.
Yeah.
And I would say, no offense, single A.
League, Derek. No, it's okay. I'm sorry. It's not too bad. Oh, come on. It's just sort of wax. No, it's okay. It's the local ice cream place where people hang out and get their ice cream and soft serve ice cream, and it's not. Well, we'll leave it at that. I'm probably getting started.
But.
Right? Yeah, that's absolutely not bad. Yeah, it's not the real thing. And what's happening here, of course, if we go to court, all that the government is doing is they're providing a forum. And they're providing a neutral judge. If it goes to a jury, we've got some citizens. And this is a dispute between two private individuals. And we get done resolving that dispute. There's not going to be any public policy that's changed. I'm maybe going to get a few extra ice cream cones as payment for having fallen in front of their ice cream shop, and that's the end of it. But what's happened, and I don't want to say this is an absolutely new thing, but it's happening a lot today, is oftentimes people will bring civil actions against another party in which the end result of that suit or that litigation is really a change in public policy. And let me give you a couple examples of that. Which I think is a really good example, one of the reasons it seems to me that we have less drunk driving in the United States today is because more bartenders know that they ought not let people leave their bars with keys in their hands if they've been drinking excessively. And that's not because any legislature sat down and created a public policy. That's because some bar owners were sued by some individuals who had gone out on the road having consumed way too much alcohol, and they shouldn't have been let on the road, and the bartender lost in that suit. And sometimes we read the newspaper and say, oh my gosh, that seems so absolutely stupid. I mean, why should a bartender be responsible for some idiot getting in a car drunk and driving? But in fact, what has happened, and I think this is a good thing, because lawyers have sued those bartenders, they have been put on notice that, you know, you can't do this. And so effectively, a kind of policy about drunk driving has been developed in the United States as a result of the courts and litigation. Has nothing to do with legislators sitting down and coming up with a new policy. I suspect this issue may come up a little bit in the current presidential election, because part of the way medicine is practiced in the United States today, it seems to me, is a result of litigation by people like John Edwards and others. I mean, there are certain kinds of things we do, perhaps some would say with more care, others would say excessive care, but they're the result of litigators going to court, getting positive, favorable judgments for their plaintiffs. And then you could say, indirectly, we have certain public policies, essentially, involving the practice of medicine without any legislator ever sitting down and creating the policy. In a sense, it's been informally devised by the courts. And let me give you just one other example, because this is an example that raises the tension between the political decision makers and the courts. There are two kinds of polio vaccine that can be used to vaccinate children against polio. One is a dead virus and one is a live one. Now, the advantage of the dead one is when that's administered to you, there's no chance that you're going to be able to get polio because it's a dead vaccine. The advantage of the live one is that, in fact, if you're a six-year-old kid, you know, you go to kindergarten, you go to first grade the day after you got that, you took that vaccination, in fact, it's going to be alive. And when you cough, it's going to be spread throughout the room, and you can say, oh, that's bad. But that's actually good, because the live vaccine, because it'll live for, I don't know, a couple days or whatever, and be sort of spread throughout society, socially, society-wise, we're able to guarantee more people will, in a sense, have that vaccination because it will expand beyond the people who literally took it, whereas if it's the dead one, the only person that's going to be vaccinated is the person who took the vaccine. So, government sits down, the Center for Disease Control and so forth, and makes some judgments and decide, socially, we're better off
if we administered the live vaccine. And I can't remember which one's the Sabin and which one's the Salk, but you know, we're better off as a society. The one danger, of course, is with the live one, is it's always possible, very minute possibility, but it's possible someone then could actually get polio because it's live as it's put into their body. So, person gets polio, person sues the drug company and says, you are at fault for this. The jury looks at that and the jury says, oh man, you know, the drug company is at fault for this. This was their vaccine. What does this do, a judgment like this? It causes the drug company to say, oh, I don't know, I don't think we want to be using this vaccine. Let's use the other vaccine. And in fact, public policy can be changed, it can be modified, even though the broader political conversation led the appropriate persons to decide that the live vaccine is better. Actions in a court by a jury and a judge can lead to an indirect change in public policy that may trump the broader policy decision by the individuals. So I'm going to leave it at that, and there's lots we could do there, but I really want to go on to the other point, and that's where I want you to talk. But I want you to be aware that one of the interesting ways that public policy is being made is by people coming to the courts and bringing suits against corporations, against automobile manufacturers, against bartenders, against drug companies. And it's a very, for me, a very complicated issue because oftentimes very good things are resulting from that. But it also puts companies and puts other operations on notice, which then causes them to dramatically, in some cases, modify their behavior. And effectively, public policy is being made as a result of those private litigations. But the second area that I'm more interested in, really, I think, that gets a lot more attention and that I think you probably might have some more interest in, is we also can take, in America, political disputes and turn them into constitutional questions. The phrase that I always use with students is the constitutionalization of politics. We have always done this in America. Tocqueville, the Frenchman, came over in the 1830s and traveled through America, and he observed this thing. And in fact, the very first Congress of the United States, we passed a national bank, which involved a huge political disagreement between the Federalist and the Jeffersonian Republicans. And the first thing they did was they translated it into a constitutional argument. Not just a political argument, but a constitutional argument. William Brennan, former justice on the Supreme Court, gave a talk at Washington, D.C. at Georgetown in 1985, and he said this. He said, the Constitution is fundamentally a public text, the monumental charter of a government and a people, and a justice of the Supreme Court must apply it to resolve public controversies. For, from our beginnings, the most important consequence of the constitutionally created separation of powers has been the American habit, extraordinary to other democracies, of casting social, economic, philosophical, and political questions in the form of lawsuits in an attempt to secure ultimate resolution by the Supreme Court. In this way, important aspects of the most fundamental issues confronting our democracy may finally arrive in the Supreme Court for judicial determination. Not infrequently, these are the issues upon which contemporary society is most deeply divided. A very good example of that, it seems to me, is the issue of abortion. And just a little bit of you know, American politics from your earlier school days. Texas passes a law that prohibits abortions. Says you can't have abortions. And that law then is essentially the result of the people of Texas. It's a democratic choice. It's a political policy choice by the people living in the state of Texas. Jane Roe, that's the name that was used in the court proceedings, says that she
was raped at a carnival and she would like to abort that fetus. It's irrelevant, but we know later that in fact that's not really how she got pregnant. And of course later she has a reversal and becomes an active opponent of abortion and becomes a spokesperson for that position. But Jane Roe is pregnant and says, this law violates my private right to have an abortion. And she then sues a man by the name of Wade, who is the appropriate representative or official, elected official in the state of Texas. And she makes her argument based on not only Texas law, but the recognition that above everything else, we have a United States Constitution. And that United States Constitution was also a democratic decision. It was created by, and let's call here the Capitol, we the people, in a sort of a one-time event. We the people got together, we constituted a nation, and said this is going to be our fundamental law, and all the laws we make have to comply with this fundamental law. And on various occasions we've added to that, so we've got, you know, it gets a little larger. And one of the things that was added to that was the 14th Amendment after the Civil War, which guaranteed equal protection and due process of the law. And Jane Roe then says, my right to have an abortion is protected by this 14th Amendment, which contains sort of a privacy right, a liberty right, and that conflicts with the law in Texas. And so we've got these people in Texas wrote this law, we the people wrote this law, the fundamental law, and now we've got a conflict between those two laws, and someone's got to decide who wins the conflict. And of course the people that decide that are the United States Supreme Court. And the United States Supreme Court in 1973 then says that in fact this Constitution protects the right to have an abortion, and therefore this law is unconstitutional. And again, from your maybe civics classes, this is called judicial review, the ability of the court to review a law or an official act by a government official, compare it to the Constitution, and if it is repugnant to the Constitution, declare it null and void. And that's what they did. Now, what they did in that opinion, and it's really interesting, it seems to me, if you ever, you know, have occasion to sit down and read the whole thing, it was written by Harry Blackmun, and for all the Minnesotans, that's it's an interesting piece of information, because remember, he went on the Supreme Court in 1969 and served on the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals for a number of years, and prior for that, lived in Rochester, Minnesota for about 10 years, I think. He was chief counsel for the Mayo Clinic. And so he felt that he sort of understood these issues from a medical perspective. And in fact, the summer before, he had spent the summer in the library because the case was argued on two occasions. It was re-argued. And he really wrote a carefully detailed, carefully crafted opinion, which actually, if you read the opinion, I think there's a symmetry in it that's really quite stunning. And in fact, he not only said that you have a right to have an abortion, but he laid out very carefully the procedures. He divided the pregnancy into trimesters and said during the first trimester, there's really no conditions by which you can't have it. During the second trimester, the state can interfere with the mechanisms for the abortion. They can lay out rules for the hospital, where it's going to take place and so forth. And during the third trimester, at this point, the state has a compelling interest in potential life that they can actually forbid abortions. But you read that opinion, and it reads just like a law. And suddenly you realize what's happened. That what began as a policy dispute, a policy disagreement between those people who thought abortion was something that ought to be allowed, and those people who thought that abortion was a bad thing that ought to be prohibited, got shifted from a public conversation, the way I might add, it took place for the most part in most of Europe, and it got shifted, and Jane Roe, actually, she didn't have to hire a lawyer because there was a woman by the name of Sarah Weddington sitting out there waiting for the right case, and they called her up and said, Sarah, I think we found the case. And she took that case and she argued it in front of a federal judge, and then eventually it got up to the Supreme Court of the United States, where the two parties argued the issue of abortion, and the Supreme Court handed down a decision. And now, after 1973, we come up with a uniform policy regarding abortion for the United States of America. Now, keep in mind, of course, they don't literally write a law, even though the opinion sometimes looked like that. All they decide is the dispute between Roe and Wade, but because of the role of precedence in judicial proceedings, that means every other court now will adhere to that, and that fundamentally becomes the public policy regarding abortion in the United States. Now this suggests, it seems to me there's sort of four really interesting issues that come out of here. Just so you're aware of them, I want to suggest them, and then we'll spend the rest of the time talking about one of those. The first question is that's central to all this is actually deciding what the Constitution means. That's a really interesting question, because the Constitution doesn't say anything about abortion. It's a really interesting question right now with regard to same-sex marriage, because some people say, well, wait a second. I got a constitutional right to marry someone regardless if they're of the opposite gender as I am. The Constitution doesn't say anything about that at all. There's a clearly established right to privacy, constitutionally guaranteed right to privacy. The Constitution talks about individual privacies, you know, you can't search and seizure, but there's no broad right to privacy. So one of the really interesting questions, it seems to me, is how we interpret the text. How do we interpret the Constitution of the United States to know whether or not it includes the right to have an abortion? Related to that is a second point, which this is one of my goals, I must admit, in my constitutional law classes, to get students to think differently. I mean, most of the time I really honestly don't, but this one I really do. And that is, who gets to interpret what the Constitution means? Because in America, most Americans, I'm convinced, believe that, well, the Supreme Court, of course. I mean, they're the final arbiters, aren't they? But, you know, when Andrew Jackson vetoed a bill that rechartered the National Bank, he said, I don't care what the Supreme Court said on this. I don't care if they said it was constitutional. I don't think it's constitutional. I took the same oath of allegiance to the Constitution of the United States as did the Supreme Court justices. And what I say the Constitution means, just as valuable as what they say it means. And I like my students to think that maybe we all can be involved interpreting the Constitution in a particular case the Supreme Court's judgment has to be final, of course. This was the great debate Lincoln had with Douglas in 1858 when they were running for the Senate from Illinois. And Lincoln lost, of course, and then went on the next 2 years later to win the presidency. And one of the things they were debating was what would happen to the Supreme Court's decision in Dred Scott if either of them got elected. Because remember, Dred Scott was the decision where the Supreme Court had this man, Dred Scott, a slave, who had spent time with his slave owner up at Fort Snelling. So think about that next time those of you from Minnesota, as you drive by there. He'd spent time up there, and he said that was free territory. And freedom it's infectious, it's contagious, and I got it! And so I'm free now. And so he went to the court to ask to be freed. And the court said, no, in fact, you have no right to be here because slaves, black slaves, were not considered citizens under the Constitution, therefore you have no standing. And furthermore, they even went a step further and said, and furthermore, the Missouri Compromise, which created those free and slave territories, actually was unconstitutional. And so Lincoln said, if I get to the Senate, I'm going to vote to renew the Missouri Compromise and essentially run contrary to the Supreme Court's judgment. And Douglas said, how can you do that? That would be anarchy. The court has spoken. They've got the final word. And Lincoln said, regarding Dred Scott, I'm not going to question their authority. I'm not going to try to free him. But regarding the policy that grew out of that, it's perfectly legitimate for the Senate to rethink the meaning of the Constitution and act contrary to the Supreme Court. So that's a second really interesting question, it seems to me, involving these, who decides what the Constitution means. The third issue, and this leads up to the fourth and the thing that I think is really important about all of this, is abortion a political matter or a constitutional matter? The very first day I talked about politics is concerned with sort of our collective affairs, and I said the issue then in part is whether something's public or private. This is the same kind of question. Is abortion a heartfelt issue in which thoughtful, careful people can disagree about it, but it's fundamentally a political disagreement? Or in fact, is it okay to take abortion and put it over in the constitutional camp and say it's essentially a constitutional matter that therefore is best decided by judges who are responsible for interpreting the Constitution? So this is really the fundamental question, it seems to me, with assisted suicide. Is that essentially a political matter in which we might be deeply divided in our nation, and somehow we have to sort through that? Or is it a constitutional question that therefore fits within this, and the Supreme Court can sit down and deliberate it for us and decide what it means? Or same-sex marriage. Is this a political dispute or a constitutional issue? And that leads then to the fourth point, which is really the question, I think, I would say, of sort of how is it best to resolve these things? In the courts or as matters of democratic political decision-making? And that's what I'd like to ask you about. Let's take the issue of same-sex marriage. I mean, it's contentious, but I think it's, therefore it's a good one. And the issue is right out there. And let's just... And forget the constitutional arguments, because trust me, there are persuasive constitutional arguments either way. I mean, you can write a strong opinion finding the right to have same-sex marriage within the Constitution. What I'm interested in is, and let's just maybe call it the courts and political, and I'm not really interested at this point in anyone saying, oh, I think this or that. I'm just interested in trying to figure out what are the advantages and disadvantages of taking an issue like same-sex marriage and leaving it to the political systems, or essentially putting it in the courts, having a couple of lawyers litigate it, and ultimately let the Supreme Court, or maybe state Supreme Courts, decide the matter of same-sex marriage, whether it ought to be allowed, whether or not states can be prohibiting it or whatever. And so let's just make a list. And these could either be advantages of having it here or here, or the arguments could be negatives, disadvantages of leaving this to the political or the courts. What are some of the thoughts you have on that?
I think one advantage would be...
For which?
For the courts saying that there would be uniformity. One disadvantage is it's set in stone. And if things don't work out well, there's no political system that can tinker with the law and try to get it to work right. You get something which is, in essence, a law that's based on the presumption that it's a constitutional decision, and this is the way it's got to be, and the legislatures can't pass anything later that will change that a little bit or change the approach.
Okay, so and we could use abortion here. So one of the advantages is there's a uniform policy. It doesn't matter whether you live in Utah, Massachusetts, Florida, Washington, you have the right to have an abortion. It's a uniform policy across the nation. The disadvantage is it's very hard to modify that or tinker with that because, and implicit there, is once the Supreme Court has made a judgment about the Constitution, that has a kind of authority that only the Supreme Court can overturn itself, or a constitutional amendment can overturn it, or a Congress could maybe sort of cut into it, but basically a Congress can't trump the Supreme Court's reading of the Constitution, is the argument. So,
well, yeah. That was part of the question that I had. I'm always telling my kids nothing is carved in stone. I guess I will come on. I don't understand how you're distinguishing between political process and the Constitution, as though the Constitution were in fact carved in stone. Are you saying that it's just so difficult to change that?
Well, once the court decides that there's a constitutional right to have an abortion, Congress can't come back the next year and say, no, there isn't a constitutional right to have an abortion.
They can't amend the Constitution.
They could amend it, right, but they couldn't do it simply with a statutory, with a law. And so the only people then that can really revise that would be the court overruling its own precedent, or coming back, and we, the people, adding to the Constitution to change it.
So you're making a distinction between, because that's for me is a political process of people. It's more difficult, but that's why I was having trouble with your distinction between the political versus the constitutional.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, that would be sort of a one-time super political action that modifies the Constitution.
That's just the degree that
right. Though it's very difficult, we know, to amend the Constitution.
Well, with the abortion situation, what we had before is we have 50 states and state legislatures to pass things. And one legislature might say, okay, you've got an absolute right to abortion for the first 6 months. And the other one might say 3 months. And another one might say only in certain circumstances during this time. And you have all kinds of different variations. And there's going to be a constant tension. Within 2 years, the legislature will sit down and take a look at that, and there'll be pressure from both sides, and they might change something if they think it's not working out right, and it's very easy to change, but once it's constitutional, it's very difficult.
So just to clarify, you're really talking about the everyday political process in the legislature versus the
courts.
The difficulty of amending the Constitution.
Oh, yeah.
But the political side, you include the executive, I assume, as
yes.
well as the legislature.
Right.
Then I guess my comment would be overall, the court's fundamental purpose, they are in the business, whether it's a lowly court or a high court, of deciding and protecting fundamental rights. The political process is geared towards determining the will of a majority or a very vocal minority, which may not always be consistent with fundamental rights. So the advantage, it seems to me, of the courts, and of course my own bias shows here, because I dealt with the courts my whole career, is...
You trust those judges, huh?
I don't trust judges and juries. I had a conversation with Jane on the way up the trail the other day about not a perfect process, but it's a messy process, but courts and juries are in the business of trying to do fundamental justice and protect fundamental rights. Legislators and presidents and governors aren't necessarily in that business.
Okay.
Has the Supreme Court overturned previous Supreme Courts very often?
It doesn't happen a lot, but they one of the most notable occasions involving fundamental rights was the first flag salute case to come in front of the court by the Jehovah's Witnesses. Three kids, I guess, didn't want to have to salute the flag, and actually it was more of this kind of a salute at that point in time instead of Pledge of Allegiance, and the court decided that it was okay to require that, and I'm so bad in history, I don't remember, it was 2-4 years later, but it was really within 5 years the court had overturned their own decision, and a number of things happened, some new people came in.
During World War II,
right.
Really emotional time.
Right. And in part, you know, a couple new people would come on the court. A couple of very liberal justices on the court were young when the first case came up, and they were more confident the second time around. And so they overturned themselves. They overturned themselves on some of the earlier decisions involving child welfare, you know, working hours laws during the early 1900s, then coming up to the New Deal. So they can change themselves.
Well, in fact, there is a hope by some that enough justices can be added to the court eventually in the process that Roe versus Wade can be overturned.
And does that lead to,
That's sort of the political influence on the judicial process, trying to shape the judicial process politically.
What do you think about that whole process? Oh, because let me put it this way. If it's true that the court begins to decide more of these hard cases involving fundamental rights, where there's disagreement in the society, the more the court does that, would you agree that the more likely then appointments to the court will be carefully scrutinized to make sure that they will be of the right mind to decide those? Would that be, you think that's probably going to happen?
I think it's already happened.
Is that okay? Or does that become an argument against the court getting too deeply involved in deciding these hard societal questions? What do you think?
But where else will those questions be decided?
My thoughts are too, though, is a lot of Supreme Court justices didn't quite turn out the way they thought they were going to be. Yeah. I mean, every president's been really ticked off at least one justice that was nominated. You know, I don't think Earl Warren was supposed to be the guy that he was nominated to be. And I don't think anybody's really quite fit the mold.
Dwight Eisenhower said, you make any mistakes when you were president? And he said, yeah, two of them, they're sitting on the Supreme Court.
And then I come from Alabama, where we have elected judges. Of course, I'm sure you've heard of Judge Roy Moore, and children know that that's mama's hot spot, you know, we're out staying off for a while on him. So these guys, they aren't protected from the political process. They aren't the political process. There's more money poured into our Supreme Court justice races than anything else. But what I see is, between the courts and politics, in some ways the courts can be very fast. You know, maybe the Massachusetts courts have moved quicker than we as a country or as a state are ready for them.
So is that a plus?
Well, I think it's just, it's there. I don't know if it's a plus. I don't know, it can be, efficient might be the word. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think it depends on what side of the court.
Well, what could it be, though? I mean, because if we go back, what you say, and back to Carl's point, is there a danger in it, In the courts, I mean, a reason for going to the political process is the courts, in fact, are too fast. I mean, abortion. Enough of you would remember. Actually, prior to 1973, it wasn't like, you know, abortion was a dead issue. It was a pretty hot political issue. If any of you are from New York, you would remember that legislature had a huge battle that ultimately resulted in liberalizing the abortion laws in New York, and I think it was a one-person vote that finally swung it. And because, it would have been 30 years ago, and because the New York Times celebrated that, I guess, at the 30-year anniversary, and they interviewed a couple of these justices, the ones who, you know, the last minute, even though their constituents thought this way, they decided to go this way. And we know that this was bubbling. I mean, it was there. There was the thalidomide scare, if you recall, in which this was really causing people to rethink the issue because, you know, children being born deformed. And there was a particular woman who actually went, I think, had to go over to Sweden to get an abortion. And sure enough, that fetus was deformed. So it was a really interesting, kind of exciting, but messy debate taking place. Was it good that it was resolved just like that in 1973 by the Supreme Court, do you think? Or would we have been better off if we'd let that kind of bubble and messy and fight?
We're bubbling now, so we're still bubbling. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, again, and the thing is, people change over time. I think my opinion on different things have evolved over time. And I think that's part of the problem. There's probably not a single person in this room who hasn't flipped, flip-flopped.
never take positions, you don't flip-flop, so I'm okay. Just one last question. I'll go. Do you think then, is that reason for not constitutionalizing it and letting it be in the political process and kind of a give and take?
I think you've got to be aware of, you know, there's advantages and disadvantages.
Okay, you can respond to that. Just people do this. They say they're going to respond, and then they go other directions. I got to be honest. My guard. No.
This is the response. The reality is that oftentimes you'll find in the major constitutional questions, the courts, in fact, do wait for enough foment. Now, do you wait for 20 years? Do you wait for 50 years? But the reality, I think, for the most part, if you do a constitutional study, courts tend to wait until the society stuff does bubble up. Now, it doesn't mean that when they make the decision, the whole society agrees with it, but it does mean there's been time for the bubbling. And some people are thinking it's too fast, and some people are thinking it's too slow. You could say now that the Massachusetts court's decision on same-sex marriage is the result of a lot of bubbling, because it's been bubbling a long time. Some people say it should bubble another 30, 50, 60 years.
You are absolutely right. I mean, historical evidence, that's exactly what's happened. The court, despite our thinking that they're leading the way, is usually following the way.
And some court has to be first to jump into the pond. Mm-hmm.
So, that's all I was going to say, is I favor the ability for that court to add the ruling and then remove it, because that allows it to change rather than just being fixed into some sort of final law. And I remember during the affirmative action ruling they had a year ago, I was at a force projection conference with the military and the Secretary of the Army, and they were in there writing a letter during the conference because it was going down, but they would like to see that in existence for another 25 years. Mm-hmm. The Army influenced by their submission and others to the Supreme Court that they would like affirmative action. So it allows these things to shift along with our development as a society.
Or let me, you know, having said that and these points, what if we thought of same-sex marriage and we combined the Constitution and the political, and the Supreme Court of the United States stayed its hand, and that we let, because we know where are we right now. I mean, the Massachusetts Supreme Court has essentially told the state, civil unions don't do. I mean, you've got to come up with a law that's going to be, it's going to involve same-sex marriage. Vermont court allowed civil unions. A New Jersey court, I think fairly recently, upheld the state's prohibition of same-sex marriage. When the Hawaii court, a number of years, am I right in this? When the Hawaii court pushed the legislature to go toward some sort of civil union or same-sex marriage, Hawaii then went and amended the Constitution. And so we're seeing, I mean, would it be okay to leave these decisions at the level of the states in a mixture of courts and legislatures among the 50 states? Or would it be okay, or would we be better off if the Supreme Court of the United States would step in? And because, see, each of these lower courts, state courts, are using their own state constitutions to make their judgments. They're not relying on the U.S. Constitution.
That's sort of true in Oregon, suicide law. And it's sort of a chance to educate people and see how it works and how it impacts society and people. And so in a way, that could be an advantage for state.
In fact, I'm gonna. This is not, you know, my language, so I can do it. I'm gonna use Louis Brandeis's language. And Louis Brandeis was, you know, a prominent labor lawyer and then became a justice on the Supreme Court. Anyone know what he called those? He called them laboratories. He called the states and these things laboratories for experimentation. And he argued that this is one of the reasons sometimes to rely on federalism, to leave these issues at the states, again, whether it be legislatures or courts, because they can be laboratories for experimentation. So two or three states take a lead, and other states say, you know, I like what they're doing in Massachusetts. Or another state says, in fact, California, if I'm right, had a proposition that prohibits same-sex marriage, but as of January 1st next year, allows for civil unions. And so you've got these interesting mixes. How do you feel about that approach? Yeah.
Well, I'm a local legislator.
Uh-huh.
And so I constantly go on the website and, you know, look for examples in other states who, you know, do progressive legislation in an area where our state is regressive or unity.
I'm not going to ask which state this is.
So. This one. There's tons of borrowing, so that it is a lab that's really working. The problem is, if you move from one state to another, and in one state you get medical insurance because your union is acknowledged as a marriage, and you, for, you know, education or job, want to move to another place, and you lose those rights, then it becomes a much, you know, stronger argument for uniformity, so that people have some expectation of how they are treated in the workplace and treated by the medical system and treated with their civil liberties in society.
But exactly in that issue on the same-sex marriage, there's so much talk about fear about how this is going to corrupt. And if we have some time to see that, you know, things aren't going to be as bad, or, you know, find out, you know, have some time, let this stuff bubble, is the word is being used. Seems to me like a very good thing. And as far as not moving around, that's what I call friction in the system for which the jurisdiction that is causing that friction is going to suffer economically or politically or both. So my big question is messing with the Constitution. To me, that seems like a really, that should be a very, very, very rare thing. Does it agree with the Constitution? Does it disagree with the Constitution? That's what I mean.
Well, again, I mean, just very quickly, I mean, you still have to ask that question every time, even back to the fundamental rights. I mean, we still have to decide. We can all agree, and I bet we all do agree in this room, the Supreme Court, one of the great advantages of judicial review is it protects fundamental rights.
No, I don't necessarily.
You don't agree with that? Come on!
look back to before the Depression, before the switch in time statement. The Supreme Court was frustrating social welfare legislation. And the legislatures were trying to protect rights of people and do things that would be useful. And the legislature saying, you can't do that. You're interfering with the contract rights of the corporations and this and that and the other thing. And stopping the social progress by using the Constitution to say, you can't do that.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. If I said Supreme Court, I really meant to say the Constitution protects fundamental rights. But no, and I think that's an extremely important point, that especially people who were educated by people who came through the Warren Court era, it's too easy to assume that the Supreme Court is always out there protecting rights, because we actually know that, you know, Dred Scott, Lochner, which was the case in New York involving working.
But at the time, they deemed themselves to be protecting what then were perceived.
That's true,
to be
property rights. Right. Yeah. Yes, that's true.
The slaves weren't deemed to have any fundamental rights, and everybody has sort of agreed with that, except the slaves themselves. So they were protecting what they deemed to be.
And so the question still then is, what is society, which of these rights are the fundamental rights?
This woman back here made the point about society changes, and thus your definition of fundamental rights changes along with it.
And you would say that it's okay to let the Supreme Court decide what those are, because basically they've got their ear, they've got, Felix Frankfurter once said, they've got their antennae out there and they're sort of sensing what they are, and they're not really going to claim something's a fundamental right until they feel pretty confident that this is in the air.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say something about it. It seems like what I've been reading is this issue of marriage is getting to be more into the contractual area, and that's going to be one thing leading to another. The courts are going to have to be aware of that, I'm sure, as they're ruling on these things. But in regard to the last point, too, about the fundamental rights, you really don't have a constitution unless you protect the right of the minority to become a majority. And that becomes an issue in some of these things, too. You know, so, you know, that's where you get the emotional issues in that. So, you can always have constitutions, constitutions are legion, you know, in history, but to last as long as ours has. I agree with Uwe here, that I wouldn't want to play around with it by adding amendments.
Sure.
But, that's one thing we've really got to be careful.
Yeah.
One thing that I'm going to I'm going to establish and pretty much agreed upon, like, sort of a precedent. And the thing, like,
look at it in the past, but you can't really like, say that that's a fundamental right.
So what do you feel about the court making that leap then? Because and saying that, you know, this is one we haven't had before, but that's our job to, Brennan would say it's a living document, and that's what we have to do. Would you feel comfortable about the court now adding the right to marriage, whether it be someone of the opposite or the same sex, within the list of things that fit within here?
Well, I think that there are a lot of, fundamental rights that I think are fundamental that haven't been acknowledged in the Constitution yet. Like, I don't think, food and housing that's really fundamental.
This is getting exactly at the issue, yeah.
Does the Constitution ever say anything about opposite sex marriage? I mean, is that something that we're just taking for granted, that's the right way? I mean, it never literally says that people have the right to marry opposite sex, so why are we assuming that, or some people are assuming that?
It doesn't say anything at all about marriage.
But the court has made decisions that clearly establish its belief that marriage is a fundamental right. So and the right to procreate is a fundamental right. And so, one of the most famous ones, they use the language of fundamental rights, even though it becomes an equal protection thing, in the case out of Virginia involving, the laws that black and white can't marry. And remember, the Constitution, there's sort of a gloss, a constitutional gloss that develops with Supreme Court opinions over time. So I think it's fair to say, I think this is an accurate statement, that it has been established by Supreme Court opinions that the Constitution guarantees or protects the right to marriage. Then the question, of course, becomes, is same-sex marriage the same as marriage? Or in fact... And it's really an interesting thing. I love it because, it'll probably be timed in, but I've used the same-sex marriage case in my constitutional law classes as a moot court case for almost over 10 years now. And I usually try to use a case that's live in front of the court so that then later in the semester or the next semester they can actually read the opinion of the opinion that they had written. But one year, I don't know, there was nothing very good out there. And I said, I think we're a couple years away from a same-sex marriage case in front of the Supreme Court, so let's use this one. And it grew out of a dispute in Washington, D.C. about 12, 15 years ago. And so about every other year I use this, and I think one of these days, fairly soon, there may be a real live case there. But I'm always struck by students will do a superb job of establishing the precedent. And they'll go through all the previous cases, and they'll establish that there is a constitutionally guaranteed right to marriage. And then they will say, which I think is a leap in logic, therefore, people of the same sex ought to be able to marry. And it seems to me all of these earlier cases presume a marriage to be a particular relationship, and therefore one has to make the argument that this relationship is sufficiently like this other relationship that we can extend the precedent to this relationship. And I don't think you can simply declare, because we call this marriage, therefore the previous cases decide. I mean, so this is what you have to work through. There we go. I guess it's time to go eat. No, it's not. I got 5 minutes left, which is good, because I got one last point I want to make. I got two points. Would you?
No, I said, because sometimes the lecturer doesn't get a chance to actually make their points because we keep it around.
No, I want you to talk.
You said something about in Europe, there was some different thing you didn't touch on.
Well, my understanding is with the abortion issue, it was much more resolved, legislatively, or in terms of debate and discussion, and it did not become sort of a single judgment by a court the way it was here. It was a much more sort of fertile, fluid debate that took place. And as an aside on that, this is really interesting. What was the case? Why am I my mind slipping here? Was it the? I don't think it was the Lawrence the homosexual case. But But it's a real interesting debate about the degree to which we ought to look to European court decisions in writing U.S. Supreme Court decisions. And there's a very, if this kind of stuff interests you, there's a very, I think, good, accessible book by a woman who teaches at Harvard, Mary Ann Glendon, and the title of the book is Rights Talk.
You remember that's the mother of a tour guide that we had in Rome in February.
No kidding. And in Rights Talk, she talks about, you know, the way Americans are so rights-oriented. And she does a really nice job of looking at our first, Bowers versus Hardwick, which was a case, a sodomy case out of Georgia that's since been overturned last year by the Supreme Court, and the Texas sodomy case. But she looks at how our Supreme Court wrote that case, that opinion, and then she looks at a comparable decision in Ireland and how that opinion was written. And it's really interesting, and part of her point is that we don't do a very good job of nuance. We don't do a very good job of sort of playing through the issues, but rather couch it in black, white kinds of language, which is so typical of American rights language.
Americans are
a Oh, absolutely. There's no question. Benjamin Franklin is our real founder, the pragmatist. We are not philosophical or theoretical at all as a people. Honestly, I don't believe that. Okay, let me just leave with two thoughts. One is simply a question that I throw out for you. We're not going to answer this question. But we could have looked at this discussion in terms of, do you think the nine justices of the Supreme Court are more equipped, are more capable, better suited to think through the issue of same-sex marriage than the American polity? And so it's partially a question of what kind of confidence do you have in the Supreme Court? Is there a feeling that judicial review and these hard decisions become sort of kind of like a national seminar in which the nine justices are sitting there and we like them to resolve these issues because there's something about them being disinterested, lifetime appointments, good minds? Are we more confident in leaving those decisions in their hands than in the hands of the American political system? So think about that. And finally, I will throw in the one point that I would make, and I do not make this point to say it carries the day. But it's one thing that didn't come up that for me is very important about this. The one thing that troubles me about relying so heavily on the courts to make these judgments is politics requires practice. And I think of Aristotle's notion about, you know, how do you get to be good? Well, by it's a habit. You get in the practice of being good. And the more you be good, you know, the more you do good, the better you get. It's not a formula. It's not something that you intellectually master. It's a habitual kind of thing. And it seems to me that politics is a habitual kind of thing. And what discourages me is on these really hard, contentious issues, instead of us all, and I know, again, this is my naive belief, and let's all go down to the marketplace and let's think through this and let's come up with something we can live with. Instead, we go out and the competing sides hire lawyers. And the lawyers go in front of the court and they make their arguments. They're sort of our proxies. And instead of being knights, you know, with armor and spears, they use words. And they argue to these ultimately nine justices who then give to us Americans an abortion policy that we will now live with. And that part of relying on the courts to make these judgments does bother me. And it does worry me that we become less and less good at doing politics. The more and more we rely on the courts to solve these hard, messy things for us. And in fact, I'll end with this one. When the Equal Rights Amendment was being debated, and at one point, you know, they've got the Senate hearing, and they're talking about what these words mean. And you remember that Equal Rights Amendment. It was pretty short, like all the amendments. And at one point, someone asked one of the senators, well, you know, what does that language there mean? He says, I don't know, we'll have to wait till it goes to the courts and they interpret it. And it seems to me, you know, this is the whole problem. But I'll leave it there.
Like a true political scientist.
So, thanks.